In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. Fun, fun,
fun, fun. Light speed to
the wondrous and wonderful.
Cover is not the book, so open it up and take a look.
Ah, if it isn't the only bookworm in town.
What's that word again?
Inspired!
Might solve a mystery or rewrite history.
This is the story we need. It's a right that's been kept out of sight for no more.
So I'll read a book, or maybe two or three. It's such fun to hum a happy working song. Ooh, a happy working song.
I have to sing. I have to play. The music, it's not just in me. It is me.
We're happier when you don't sing.
Welcome to Notably Disney, your ultimate podcast covering Disney music and books. I'm Brett Nachman, your host. Here we dig a little deeper and explore the great wide somewhere about everything under the Walt Disney Company umbrella as it pertains to tunes and writing, from the theme parks and television screens to the Broadway stage and the silver screen, if it relates to anything Disney songs, soundtracks, books, articles, or other things that you can listen to or read about involving Disney, we'll examine it here. Although many of us are familiar with the Disney artists, including singers and songwriters, who have delivered many of our favorite tunes from the Mouse House, there are unsung heroes who also have some stories to share. Today on Notably Disney, I welcome on music producer Bambi Moe, who discusses her experiences with some top-notch Hollywood talent in a lovely book called Part of the Magic, a collection of Disney-inspired brushes with greatness. So, as you will soon hear, Bambi relays some amazing anecdotes of bringing a dose of pixie dust to Disney music across the 80s, 90s, and beyond. And we're going to discuss some of those topics as springboards for larger conversations about some very cool experiences in working for the Walt Disney Company. Bambi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Brett. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to talking to you today.
Me too. And we're going to dive into some of the various stories and experiences that you've had with Disney. But I feel like it's only appropriate that we begin our conversation by talking about you, sharing with listeners why you felt like now was the right time to reflect on your career and Disney-inspired brushes with greatness in the form of a book.
Well, a lot of it had to do with the fact that I worked at the company during a time in an era where I was seeing very little, really little coverage about the behind the scenes. And with the advent of Disney Plus, a lot of the programming and specifically the television animation shows I worked on, as well as the direct-to-video sequels and also films like A Goofy Movie, I found there was suddenly all this interest from people contacting or reaching out and wanting to know more about that era. So that kind of was the timing of it. And then, of course, COVID happened, and it gave me another opportunity, which was unexpected, to really examine and look at all the invisible threads that connected me, specifically me, to the Disney company from birth. So the book took a form that and a shape all its own in a way. And it felt like now was really the time to share that, since so much of what I'd be talking about is there's currently a lot of interest. Also, I think that if we don't tell our stories go when we go. And that's what I was starting to notice. A lot of the talent I was privileged to work with are no longer with us. And I just felt that it was kind of my responsibility to make sure that those stories didn't go away.
I appreciate the notion of that. That's the vitality of cataloging, whether it be in form of journaling or diaries for folks at a personal level, or in your format, being able to share those professional experiences all cataloged within a nice compendium of a book. And what's really nice about your book is how it's not only this great written context that you offer, but also mementos, pictures of musical programs and photos and autographs and the like. How did you determine what to include, given that you have such a wealth of different interactions and experiences during your time with the company, but also in other contexts as well?
Well, I think I have somewhere in my DNA, I have a collector gene. So I love collections and I love stories. And it made sense to me that if I was going to write a book and I was going to tell the stories, that there needed to be a component to it that visually illustrated that would support whatever the reader was experiencing. So I also really wanted to avoid that thing that can sometimes happen is, oh, there's Bambi with this other person, or here's Bambi again with another person. I tried to avoid the photos with me with people, and I tried to think about, well, what do I have that would really illustrate that story, that would be something that if I were interested in the subject matter, what would I want to see? So I kind of took the place of the reader as I was writing it. And I was fortunate, because I do have that collector gene, to be able to draw from a pool of different kinds of collections of things. So that added to the fun of putting the book together.
For sure. Well, and as readers, we definitely see an assortment of those trinkets and items that obviously have a lot of significance. Now, your title is very intentional. This term of brushes with greatness, or BWG, as is referred to. For the unacquainted, can you describe what you view as a brush with greatness and why you leaned into that term? I know you touched on it a bit at the beginning of the book, but I feel like for those unfamiliar, it's worth noting why you incorporated that.
Yes, I appreciate you asking that, because a brush with greatness was an idea or a concept that I thought a lot about, because I didn't think about, oh, well, I'm determining what's great. That isn't the point of it. A brush with greatness is almost the idea of, it's like capturing a photographic moment in time, I think is how I describe it in the book. Funnily enough, when I was a young executive and we used to have Monday morning quarterback meetings where we'd all talk about what went on during the weekend to get kind of the creative juices flowing. The term was used, I'm pretty sure that's where I don't know if I first heard it there, but the term was used, did anybody have any brushes with greatness over the weekend? And I seemed to have more than everybody else, and not by design or plan, just like these happy accidents. So I think that was where the back of my mind, that's where the brush with greatness idea came from. And again, it's almost like it's a way to think about the telling of a story and being able to, in you know, select it one story from another depending on the richness of that particular story. So my brushes with greatness extended, quite frankly, beyond just my career at Disney. And as I thought about those, I said, well, you know, again, I'm not judging what's great. I'm just kind of, for lack of a better way to describe it, I'm kind of the observer. I'm the fly on the wall. The stories are not about the fly on the wall. They're about what goes on in that room or in that space. So, and those, I just had to figure out a way to describe them as brushes with greatness, or I call them BWGs. And then I also think that in trying to figure out what a brush with greatness was, it's like there are different kinds of brushes with greatness, meaning, like I defined it, you could have more than one brush with the same person, or you could have an experience that you go, oh my gosh, I really wish I didn't have that one. or that encounter. I guess it's another way of saying encounter, but encounter isn't exactly it either, because they're kind of, they're more than just a sighting. They're an actual impactful experience, if that's a way to, if that answers your question.
Yeah, that makes clear sense. One word that I often use in conversation and I like in life is this notion of something being fortuitous or fortunate or lucky or coincidental, and there, it's symbolic. It's something that you perhaps maybe don't anticipate, but it has meaning. And that's a word that surfaced for me in reading through a bunch of these anecdotes, is that some of these, you know, you have these encounters, if you will, that you referred to, that you had with folks sometimes on multiple occasions, that unfolded in the most unlikely of places, whether it be in an airplane or airport or in other spaces. And I could clearly see, as I progressed through the book, the thread lines that you illustrate across different people and contexts and stories.
Well, you know, adding to what you just said, there's another word that pops into my mind. And I, as we're talking about this, it's synchronicity. Mm. There's a certain kind of synchronicity that happens. And that's happened in my life. And so I think that's another aspect to that brush with greatness idea. Well, and also invisible threads. I'm discovering invisible threads even to, after the book's already out, and I'm discovering things that oh wow, that tied with, I found an old calendar that had a date on it. And in the date, it said that I was at a recording session, and I'm looking at the recording session to see what it was a recording session of. And this happened just, I'm not kidding. This happened like 2 weeks ago. I look at it and it said Weddington Studio, May 1980s. I don't know, 81 or two. And it said Barbie session. And I had completely forgotten that I had produced a Barbie read-along book and record. And it listed out who the Barbie was, which was the fabulous Desiree Goyette, who is in my book and talked about because she was the singer of the Flash Beagle album, which is, there's a story in the book about. And then I looked at the other name, which my Ken was a voice actor and performed as Ken. And it was Dawn Grady, who was one of the Mouseketeers. Wow. And again, I'm going, look at the threads, they're still there. In fact, I might have to do a post of the Barbie record, considering how popular Barbie has become.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
What was so fascinating for me too, being acquainted with different Disney parts of history, you know, you become familiar with different components based on what's been more publicly documented or what's in different spaces. But then over time, at least from an observer standpoint, you ascertain a larger picture. And so I think what's been really fascinating for me as a consumer of the book, and also as we chat further, is to see how many different threads, again, that Disney has had over the years across different different industries, different spaces within entertainment, and also in different places, because much of your book also attends to experiences you've had with talent outside of the United States. So it really becomes clear that it's almost like a web that just extends in so many different directions, much like social networks, which you've also alluded to.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I found these, again, invisible threads are the idea of all these threads, and then the threads becoming a fabric, and the fabric becoming a story of one's experience. Because you're right, a lot of the stories do take like place overseas. I have a wonderful story about my working experience with Robin Williams, who came back as the genie for the project that, you know, I was the music executive, music producer on. So we had to get, you know, Robin to sing and record songs as the genie. And And you know, I again, not to give the too much of the story away, it's really it's one of my fondest memories, but it the only time Robin could record was when he was on family holiday in Ireland. And I'll leave it at that, but you can only imagine the challenges for me, the young music executive sitting in Burbank, trying to figure out how on earth are we going to record with Robin Williams in Ireland.
It just feels like a setup for so many impressions that he would be delivering it with an Irish accent.
Well, and you know, it's funny too, because there are so many incredible orchestras all over the globe. And that's another thing that I had the privilege of being able to record in different countries and with different orchestras, whether it was in, you know, London, you know, with members of the London Symphony Orchestra, or, you know, or in Australia, or, you know, just all over. So it was really a very exciting international experience.
For sure. Well, I want to dive into some of the specific projects that you mentioned, but maybe more fleetingly in the book, and perhaps could elaborate on here if you're so inclined, the Disney Sing-Along Songs series, which for which you were an associate producer. That was, it, you know, came about in the 1980s during this birth of home video becoming such an institution for so many households. What was your role in getting that not only off the ground and manifesting in a variety of different video titles, but also in handling some of the vocals too?
Well, all credit to two individuals, Phil Savinick, who is a very well-known producer, and that's Savinick, Savenick, for your listeners. Google him, and Harry Ahrens. They were tasked with the notion of let's do Disney sing-alongs, you know, where you'd see, because there's so many classic songs, obviously, in the library. And at the time, it was, if I'm not mistaken, I don't even think DTVs were happening yet, which are Disney Music Television. I think this just predated that. And I got the job after meeting Phil because I had worked at the Disney Record Company and had just had some success with creating music videos that supported our song albums. And the song album in particular was an album called Totally Mini. And two music videos that I produced, I edited and produced, was Hey Mickey and the title track, Totally Mini. Well, in putting those music videos together, which ultimately ran on MTV, which was kind of unheard of. I mean, they were like the earliest animated music video. I think they ran in the middle of the night. And I don't know, I can't tell you how many times they were in rotation, but what happened was I became very familiar with the animation cartoon with the library. And I actually had to go through and research which ones had separate music and effects tracks, music effects and dialogue. And the ones that had separate tracks obviously were the ones that were more readily available to edit and use. So since I had that kind of knowledge when the sing-along songs were being developed, I could bring the knowledge of the Disney cartoon animation library with me, and was part of the, and I was the associate producer, as you said, of the first seven volumes of Disney sing-along songs. So that was more or less what led to that. And ultimately, because of my background in music, I was very much involved and instrumental in creating the main title and hiring the individual who wrote the main title theme, a fella named Pat DeReamer. And because we were a very small group, and you know, I had previously actually sung on a couple of Disney projects. I was part of the group that was put together that sang on the main title theme for the Disney sing-along songs. So I just want to say it was a time that was really fun and exciting, and we all wore 7 different hats at any given time. So and because we were a small group, we had a lot of fun. We really did. So
technically there are Disney characters that are tethered to your voice, because I can just see those little birds in the bird in the schoolhouse.
Yes, that's me. Yes. Don't ask me to sing. It's too early.
I won't. I'll hold back on that. I feel like you're partially responsible for so many VCRs crashing because of kids, myself included, just playing those videos over and over and over again.
Well, you know, it's really funny that you mentioned that, playing over and over again, because out of all the things that I've had my name accredited to or with, or, you know, whatever, wherever my name might appear on something that, you know, was Disney, the thing that I seem to have the most recognition for working on are the sing-along songs. Mothers used to tell me, "Oh, I know who you are. I saw your name in the credits. I appreciate," because my kids, it used to be the best tool. I could leave my kids guilt-free knowing that they were going to learn something and be entertained at the same time.
The Disney notion of edutainment at its finest.
Yes, there you go.
And I was really struck in terms of so many stories I found quite compelling, but you talk about in the book, to some extent, the challenges associated with a full animated television series. So The Little Mermaid as an illustration of that, and later Aladdin and others, but where you're essentially trying to find the right songwriter for each episode, where, you know, at least with Little Mermaid, so many of the episodes featuring songs. What I don't know if I have a specific I don't know if there's a specific answer that I'm seeking out of this, but in terms of drawing on your networks and knowledge of the music industry to bring in such a wide variety of individuals, I gathered from the book that you had to be very thoughtful and also deliberate in getting a variety of people on board. But I'm wondering if you could maybe share with listeners how you reflect on that period where it's so much music in a very concentrated period.
Wow. I think that a lot of it has to do with my childhood growing up. I used to literally read liner notes, album jackets. I had a 45 collection. And I don't know why, but I just found that the information contained therein had meaning to me. And so I became familiar with who those songwriters were, who those musicians were, who those artists singing were. So I, and if you would have told me when I was a little kid that, oh, there'd be this job that, you know, that background or that information would be useful, I would have been shocked and said, well, sign me up. And I think that's another thing that maybe synchronicity or destiny or however you want to describe it, clearly meant to be. I think that coupled with the fact that my first job was in a record store, I worked at an independent record store, and I then worked for a record chain, Warehouse Records. Again, I mentioned this because I think I without knowing it, without really by design or intention, I developed my own little research library in my mind. So when, and I continued, I mean, this, if that's your passion or your interest, it's going to continue and grow as you continue and grow. So by the time I got the position at Disney, I had a pretty good library of knowledge around songwriters. And And I think that, because I've been asked the question before, and I think that part of it is that, how do you describe your own intuition? I mean, it's an intuitive thing for me. I treated the assignment as a casting assignment, as you would cast the best actor or actress for a role. I would look at it and say, I'm casting the best, you know, songwriter for the particular. And once you find songwriters who have the sensibility for the projects you're working on, you know, you develop a shorthand as well. Because I remember thinking when we were tackling, yes, Little Mermaid certainly had a song in every episode. But I think we did, you know, initially, I think we did 10 or 12 episodes. I don't remember the exact number, but, and then we did another season of it. But then a show like Hercules, where I think we did, gosh, at least you might know better than I, but maybe like 75 or 80 episodes, and a large number of them had songs. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's a combination of a lot of things, but it started really, really early on for me. And it was a passion, and it was an interest, and that interest and passion grew and then became very useful when I got the job and had an opportunity to develop those shorthand languages with songwriters and then see the songs to fruition, which is, you know, that's half the fun is getting there, and then the other half is finishing.
That also harkens back to what you alluded to earlier, where you're a collector of information and resources and items that have meaning. It sounds like in that same way, with the resources at your disposal, you were handling that at a young age with liner notes and other materials for the music that you consume. So consequently, you had that foundation when you were putting it into good use.
Yeah, I love singer-songwriters. I think they're magicians. I even describe them as that in the book. They you know, they're just, I don't know how they do it, and I admire it greatly. And I've been as close to it as you could possibly get without creating it yourself. And it's extraordinary. So and you know, again, we're talking about songs that are being written for a specific purpose. In many cases, whether it's for a main title theme, or it's for a specific character, it needs to do something. It needs to enhance the story, because everything is really about the story and the story and storytelling. So, you know, much of the rooting of the, also I love the theater. And so it's a sort of a natural thing too, because theater and musicals, that's what they're about, is musical storytelling.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head that any consumer or producer of music recognizes how music is to propel the story. And if it doesn't, it could still be enjoyable, but maybe it doesn't drive the narrative in the same significant way. And I wonder too, how you make sense of that when you're in a position in working on these direct-to-video films, where you had a foundation of a story, or at least a foundation because of the characters being familiar in most cases. But then here, you know, trying to create tunes that are maybe in the spirit of the original film, but also honoring the intent and scope of the sequel. How did you negotiate that in terms of with the development of new songs that could honor those different priorities?
Well, there are two projects I could speak pretty specifically about that addresses what you're talking about. One of them was when you have a film like, let's say, Beauty and the Beast, and Beauty and the Beast written by geniuses, you know, Howard Ashman and Alan Menken. So if I don't have access to be able to have Howard Ashman and Alan Menken write songs for my midquel project, which is the telling of what was going on in the castle with the Beast and Belle during that Christmas that they were together. If they're not available, then for me, it was almost a crisis moment. How do you possibly, the audience is so in love with the music from Beauty and the Beast. How do you come up with anything that's going to be acceptable, let alone good? You know what I mean? So I was faced with a huge challenge with that. And I tell a story in the book very specifically about how that came about. So I don't want to give all of that away. The other example was working on a Goofy movie where you have two kinds of songs at play in a way. You have songs that are character-driven songs that are very specific about Goofy, his son Max, and a road trip that they go on together. And also it's a coming of age story for Goofy's son. So you have that aspect of the project, but at the same time, there's another story element, and that's that Goofy's son Max wants to go to a concert given by a contemporary character of the time. So then the question becomes, how on earth do you create a song that will have a contemporary feel that could potentially be classic in its own appeal, in its own creation? So in that instance, we had a songwriting team that wrote the character songs, and that was Jack Feldman and Tom Snow. And then we had the songwriting team of Patrick DeRemer, who, again, from earlier, wrote the songs, the Powerline songs. That's the concert I was just talking about, with a guy named Roy Freeland. And again, it's just, it's understanding what is needed in terms of the songwriting for a project that didn't necessarily have any reference. The audience didn't have any reference to Disney, to Goofy songs, you know? So it's two very, very different kinds of scenarios. And it was my job to solve the challenges and hopefully create a great musical score for both projects, which ultimately I'm pretty proud of those, I have to say. I mean, they've held up, especially, I'm shocked at how beloved a Goofy movie is. I mean, it's wonderful. And of course, the producer of the Powerline songs is a legend anyway, David Z, or David Rifkin, who produced Prince's Purple Rain. So yeah, we had some pretty cool people involved in the project. And Tevin Campbell, oh my gosh, I forgot to mention Tevin Campbell, who sang the Powerline songs. So yeah, it's really great fun.
What's so fun about so many of these projects, and I think a Goofy movie is perhaps a bit exceptional in the circumstance of both being a time capsule of its period, but also in the space of timelessness. And I think that's the mark of a really good project, where it's not only reflecting what can be current and perhaps sometimes for the context of the film that's fitting, sometimes it's not, but also that almost three decades later, it holds up and the music's still awesome, and there's this cult classic status that I think it's earned over these years, which is quite remarkable in all the best ways.
Well, it tickles me. I recently went to see a Goofy movie here in Los Angeles at the El Capitan. They had a week screen, and I actually went with David to see it. And I tell you, it was just thrilling. It was really thrilling. By the way, you know, it's funny. A Goofy movie for me was the first feature film that I knew was getting a theatrical release that I ever worked on. And I do think it was Kevin Lima, who was the director. I think it was his first feature film as well. And I think that it was a synchronicity of being a first, that we wanted it to be great. You know, we just did. We put our heart and soul. I know that you know, there's never a guarantee, but I really think that everybody who worked on that project just, it was a first, and there's something magical about firsts, you know?
For sure. Well, and there, I think if memory serves me right, Bambi, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was the DuckTales Treasure of the Lost Lamb film the first from Disney Television Animation to get in that brand a theatrical release outside of feature animation?
Well, I wasn't working for television animation at that time.
Right.
I was working for Disney, but I was not working at television animation. So, but I do believe you're right. I think that was. So I don't think that the expectation was, we were not the feature animation division. And I don't think that, they necessarily thought that our projects were going to, you know, be as successful. I might be wrong, but that's my impression of them at the time, thinking we weren't going to get the same kind of support that we would get, that the feature animation people would get on their projects. But that didn't matter. You know, it was almost like the little engine that could. We just kept going, you know, and hoping for the best. So yes, I do think that DuckTales was first.
And that wasn't, forgive me, that wasn't meant to, as a correction or anything along those lines. I think it's more of to illustrate that was 5 years, or 4 or 5 years earlier, and yet you have a Goofy movie, like right around the time of, you know, Pocahontas and before Toy Story. And ultimately it's considered in that classic 90s period because of the quality of the storytelling with the music, which I think is nice, that even though there was a distinction in the team associated with that versus maybe feature animation at times, ultimately it holds up and it belongs as part of that collective, which is a nice legacy.
It is. And I think that, and I should explain to your listeners too, that the gentleman who was the head of the Disney record company ultimately became the president of Disney Television Animation, Gary Kreisel. So I knew Gary from my record company days. And Gary and his team put together Television Animation, and I continued to work at the record company. And then I did a stint working at Disney Home Video as well.
One theme that I picked up from reading your book was how a number of talented folks from or closely associated with feature animation ultimately played an instrumental role with television animation and direct-to-video fare. And so you speak at length about the Aladdin sequels, which I recently revisited. And I was so pleasantly surprised that they not only hold up quite well, but are still extremely funny. I quite enjoyed them. And I was talking with my partner the other day about how much I love Forget About Love from Return of Jafar, among other things. But I was, you know, you mentioned this at the beginning of our conversation, that a lot of folks that you've worked with have unfortunately now passed, and one recent person in that space is Gilbert Gottfried.
Gilbert, oh, I love Iago. Gilbert. Oh my gosh, I felt like Gilbert. Sometimes you work with a talent, and you know you get the job done, and they go on their way. But Gilbert was one of those people who, every time I was in New York, whether I was working on an Aladdin project or not, I would make sure that I would get to see while I was in New York, because that's where he lived. So I really did consider Gilbert a friend, and he is so, so sorely missed. He was so talented. He was so kind-hearted and smart and self-effacing and just so much fun to be around.
What do you think most people wouldn't have known about him that you came to appreciate at more of a personal level?
You know, he really was so humble. I think it's his humility. He was just, and he was so kind. I've never told this story. I don't know if I should, but well, what the heck? He invited me to a Conan O'Brien after party or after a show taping, and it was in New York. And somebody, and I can't think of his name, but one of the guys who worked on the Howard Stern show accidentally elbowed me in the face. And we thought my nose was broken. And poor Gilbert, I'll never forget this. He was so panicked that I had gotten hurt. I must have looked ridiculous. I probably had ice packs that were sort of made from the bar, the ice in the bar in this place. I don't even remember. But he was just really, and I laughed so hard. I was in so much pain from the being hit in the face, but he just made me laugh, and somehow that made me feel better. And he is just very, very dear.
Aw, I'm sorry for that. He's no longer in your world. It sounds like he had a really positive, lasting impression.
Sure did.
I definitely was pleasantly reminded when I watched Return of Jafar. It's more about an Iago redemption story than anything else. I don't think I remembered that so much, and I quite enjoyed it.
Well, I have to find it. Gilbert had such a funny sense of humor. He gave me an 8x10, okay, of his a photo of him, an 8x10, and he signed it to me. But he it had Dear Mr. Bluth, and they crossed out Bluth, and Dear da, da, and so, and then they put my name in. I have that somewhere. He was just he was shocked when I told him he was going to sing initially. I mean, really sing. And he did. He did such a good job, I thought, on the songs. Whenever he had a line or had to carry it, he just gave it his all. And that's something in directing actors or performers who aren't known for singing, the best thing that I could say to anyone is to make them feel comfortable and at ease, and not to worry about how good or how pretty or how nice they sound. Just trust that they know what their character sounds like. So it's whatever the character, however the character sounds, that's going to be okay. You know, that's going to work. And that's what we did with Gilbert. And also the other non-singer that comes to mind is James Woods, not known for his singing. We talked a little, I talked a little bit about it with him, and he really took kind of a Rex Harrison talk singing approach, you know, to the songs. Because again, not particularly comfortable with singing songs, and yet they were required of the character.
You make the best of the situation, and ultimately it worked for Gilbert at the very least. I'd have to be refreshed of Hades singing. I haven't heard that in recent memory, but
it's definitely he made it work. That's all I'll say. He made it work. But we had other singers that were non-singers that had to sing songs. I mean, you know, you wouldn't think Bobcat Goldthwait would have had a a song. And yet, I don't know. Sometimes I really, thinking back, I wonder if maybe the writers or the showrunners, directors used to just love to come up with these challenges just to see what it would be like, you know?
It pushes the boundaries of what you would expect from certain talent, so that you now have a greater range as a result.
Yes, there you go.
You mentioned Beating the Beast a few minutes ago, and I want to ask you, because you mentioned it briefly in the book, but didn't elaborate on it. So clearly you all were interested in ultimately delivered with The Enchanted Christmas, you said that the team wasn't aiming for an animated television series. I know there was the Sing Me a Story with Belle. I remember watching that. But why wasn't there interest, or do you have perspective into why there was not interest into it in terms of an animated series, much like Aladdin and Little Mermaid?
I think because Beauty and the Beast, just from what I remember, just it was considered, it was instantly considered a classic. I mean, you know, and to what would the story, if you think about it, what would the story be about, really? Belle, after she was together with the Beast? Or, you know, or really, what would the story be if you talked about Belle and everybody's fear of the Beast? I mean, there really was, if you think about it, there really wasn't a lot of, I don't know where you would take it. That's why the thought was, well, they're not going to do an animated series, but what stories could we tell? And that's why, I mean, I don't even know if a midquel is the right word, but if it's a story that takes place within the original story and it's at the midpoint in the story, that's where midquel comes from. It's not a sequel. It's a midquel. So I don't know, you know, again, I wasn't privy to knowing the thought processes about not doing a series with those characters. But as I look back on it, I would think I would be challenged to figure how you could sustain that over, you know, 12 episodes.
That's totally fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I especially think about it from the standpoint of would you have all the characters in their human form as opposed to as enchanted objects, and would that be as compelling? So
exactly.
Interesting. I you know, you talked about all the celebrities that that you enjoyed working with and positive brushes of greatness. You do mention some instances of perhaps not the most viable and rewarding interactions. What are your takeaways of when perhaps those interactions with certain folks who were in the spotlight weren't as positive? What are your reflections or takeaways at a broader level? I won't call out any specific ones that you noted in the book, but there are a few where you don't hold back in terms of being candid.
Well, boy, that's I know exactly. I know exactly who you're referring to and what you're referring to. The truth of it is that you have to tell the truth. And I do. That's it. It's as I remember it. That's what these stories are. You know, if somebody else has a different perspective, then that's their truth of their experience. But so, you know, I wasn't by any intention trying to make things sound like they were always sweetness and light. The truth is there things are never always just that. So you are going to have experiences of challenges, like, you know, some talent, they're going to be coming in and it's going to be a bad day for them. And they're going to just want to get out of the studio as quickly as they can. Or it might be that someone is cast in a part, and when they originally did it, maybe they were at a better place in their life at that time, that by the time I get to work with them, which is considerably later on whatever the sequel project is or the series is, that they may have developed some problems in their life. And then they bring those problems to the, and you still have to elicit a performance from them. So I just tried to you know, tell the story of what my experiences were. For example, a lot of people didn't know that Kathleen Turner, for example, had been cast as the villainess in the Lion King sequel. And it was something that just didn't work out. And I talk about what that experience was. And then Suzanne Plachette is cast as that. And she's the villain. That's who you hear. I think her character was Zira, for my brain. Wow. I can't even believe what I can remember sometimes. It's kind of frightening to me that I have a computer chip of a brain here. But Anyway, and Suzanne Plachette was fabulous and funny. And I couldn't even believe some of the things that she was saying that we'll just describe as the bluest language that one could, and bawdy and funny, and made us all laugh, and did a terrific job. So, you know, I just try to tell the truth from my perspective, and that's, you know, that's all I can really say, you know. And yeah. and there were a couple others that were, you know, challenging in terms of the behavior that went on, but you know, nothing that bad.
Right. Everything is as I frame in life, like everything is a learning experience, not necessarily that you immediately get a takeaway out of it, but it's still something that you can reflect on of like, oh, this isn't the trait I like, or this is, you know, maybe there's a contextual factor behind why individuals are engaging in this manner. But I had a laugh when you said bluest when describing Suzanne Plachette, because it made me think of Jeannie, Robin Williams, very blue in terms of his physical form, but also in terms of probably some of the outrageous impressions and remarks from such a comedy legend there too.
Well, so. She said something about having the bluest, something about sounding, something about sailors could drink a sail. I don't remember, but whatever it was, she was very self-effacing and funny.
As we wrap up, I want to make reference to maybe one or two other projects, and then I have some reflective questions, if you will. You don't talk about it much in the book or at all, if I recall, but one project I saw that you were connected with was The Weekenders, the Disney animated series.
Yeah.
About that. It was a great show.
Oh, you know, it's funny. The director, the show director, writer was it Doug Langdale? Do you know?
I'd have to look it up.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, but I think it was. Here's the thing about The Weekenders that I do remember. Wayne Brady.
Yes.
Wayne Brady came into the studio. He, I guess, knew the, and that's why I feel bad if I got it wrong, and it's not Doug, but he knew the creator of the show. And the creator of the show asked to have Wayne come in, and with the intention of creating a main title. And what was really interesting about that experience is that Wayne's improvisational skill was at its highest. And I'm not kidding, he just came in and nailed it. It was probably the fastest recording session I've ever had.
Well, and we know him from Whose Line Is It Anyway? He thinks quick on his feet and he delivers every time.
Yeah, and that was the experience. So that's what I remember about The Weekenders.
I just looked it up, Bambi. Doug Langdale was in fact the creator. So
thank you. I feel now I don't feel bad. My brain is still intact.
What comes to mind to me in thinking about so many of the projects that you're attached to and played such a big role in is that you're right, with Disney Plus, many of the, especially the direct-to-video sequels are available for folks to watch and engage with newer generations. But there's also a number of shows, The Weekenders included, that aren't on Disney Plus, and consequently folks may be relying on, if they can find stuff on YouTube or old video recordings or whatnot. What do you hope is the lasting impression of the projects that you're attached to, some of which are not necessarily the original property like Beating the Beast, but you know, the midquel or others? In many ways, so many of your projects are extensions of familiar brands, but also in the case of some of the television series, newer characters. What do you hope is the lasting legacy of these projects that were supplementarily to some of these other projects that are much more familiar in the general Disney mold, if you will?
Well, I think it kind of concerns me that as we move on through time and we look back, that it's almost as if no one will remember, well, who was involved or who was there or who was responsible for creating that. I think it's really important, again, to make sure that those legacies aren't forgotten. I don't mean mine personally, but obviously I am a part of really what I think is an incredible, I mean, I am so fortunate and blessed to have been a part of this particular musical legacy. So if I've contributed and I've added in any way, I mean, that's enough. Except that I think that for generations to come, the interest in historically, who are the people involved? How did this come about? If I can help, and that's part of why the book was really written, was to inspire and to remember those individuals who would otherwise be forgotten. I think that's part of it. That's why I think I think there's a tendency, or there was, at least when I was a young executive there at Disney, that it was all about the Disney name and that individuals really weren't recognized necessarily for being part of that creative process. And I understand that to a certain degree or a certain extent, but when you're talking about, you know, new generations discovering things that were created, you know, 30 years ago, that those new generations want to know. And so I hopefully can, at least, as you say, the shows and the things that I worked on, some of them might not be the, like the Weekenders. So people might not know anything about the Weekenders and they may not get to see it, but that doesn't mean there won't be an audience that will ultimately discover it. And we don't know, who knows, Disney may decide to put the Weekenders on Disney Plus at some point because there's an interest in it. So I just think it's really important to document, to maintain that legacy. That's really what it is. It's more of a maintaining of the legacy. And the way to do that is to give the people that were involved the credit and the rest, because a lot of times, by the way, songwriters, producers, artists were not credited. And so, you know, that's something that I'd like to at least have a small part of making sure that the things that I was involved with are recognized and the people that were involved with it are credited.
Absolutely. Because
credit is such a small thing to, it doesn't cost anybody anything, but give them credit where it's due, you know?
Yeah, such an astute point. And I feel like that, you know, the earliest decades of Disney, even thinking about the masterpiece animated films, how, you know, the credits were relatively small on screen, but we know there are so many people behind the scenes, the ink and painters and specific musicians and other folks involved. And I think, you know, as Hollywood has evolved, and thanks to resources like IMDb and others, there's a way of being able to provide a more exhaustive list. But I appreciate how you honed in on that, because I think that is the unique contribution that folks like yourself make in cataloging these stories in book form and talking about them in other contexts too.
And also give credit where it's due, podcasts like yours. I mean, they're really important. And you know, I mean, you're notably Disney, and covering music and books about, and you know, that's so important because that's an opportunity that provides the opportunity for those of us who were involved in the process to tell our stories. Thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, and I feel like just the biggest point of, if something's not documented, there's, you're absolutely right. Something can very well die when the person is no longer present. So let there be a way of capturing that in, you know, in the right space in an authentic manner, and hopefully as thoroughly as the space provides. You know, I recognize that you're an educator as well, and you talk, and in your book, there's a reference to how you teach music business students. What are some of the lessons that you instill in them that maybe derive from your career and experiences?
I believe that you can be the most creative person, but without a plan, nobody's going to know about it. And so one of the things that I really just tried to instill in the students that I taught over the time, the 7 years I taught at Cal Poly Pomona, I'm not teaching there now, but when I did, I wanted the students to have and understand what a marketing plan is. Any plan, but a plan, so that, I mean, nowadays it's so much easier because social media does so much to, but it's having a understanding what branding is, and understanding why it's important to have a strategy, a plan, and then how to execute that. So those were the things that as an instructor at a college level, but then I also enjoy teaching reading to, young kids who are learning how to read. And so I just really believe in the idea of paying it forward, you know, and supporting music and art in school and in whatever way we can, and hopefully inspiring young talent in all areas. I actually have a neighbor whose daughter is wants a career in the music business, and she's in a band and she plays bass in that band, and she's quite good. But what she recognizes, which really tickles me, and we've had many conversations, is how important it is to be able to know how to promote and market and book that band. And so the business side of it. And I have always been someone who has had both the left and the right brain going. So I've had the business and the creative. And so I try to hopefully, by example, share with young people that it's really important to kind of have a sense of both.
Absolutely, that makes perfect sense. Because it's all about tapping into different skills depending on the context. I appreciate that. Well, Mamie, at this point, I'd like to transition to some Disney opinion related questions, and then we'll conclude with giving listeners some context on where they can pick up a copy of your book. Does that sound like a good plan?
Sure.
Okay, well, let's dive into some music questions that I ask of my guests. First off, what Disney soundtrack did you listen to most while growing up?
soundtrack to Mary Poppins. The Sherman Brothers, my heroes.
And you got to work with them on the Tigger movie.
Oh, I worked with them. Yes, I did. And I miss Bob terribly. I'm sorry, Robert Sherman. And Richard is with us, and thank goodness. And I just, they're extraordinary. So yeah. Probably a soundtrack. Mary Poppins, and because it had a personal I had a personal connection to it.
Lovely. What Disney song most recently became stuck in your head?
Oh, come on. Let It Go. And I got to work with Adina, and that was really pretty thrilling as well, before she became Adina.
Yeah, that feels like a documentary, Adina before Adina.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing. Thanks to Hercules. It was a song in Hercules.
Yeah, and there are so many folks in the latter 90s who became such big Broadway stars who had connections to animation as well. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
What Disney film do you feel is the most underrated music? And you are welcome to choose one of your own that you're connected to if you feel that fits the bill.
Well, again, underrated means I'm comparing it to something else. So I think that the two films that I truly, well, oh gosh, now I'm thinking about the Tigger movie. That's like asking you to pick your favorite child and give them an extra plug.
So then you can choose a film that you're
really
not
hard.
To.
No, but I think that the songs from a Tigger movie and Beauty and the Beast, The Enchanted Christmas, and a Goofy movie, they all stand out in my mind. Pooh's Grand Adventure. I don't know if you've revisited that one in a while, but that was a special little one with great songs.
Yeah, well, and that was, I feel like, the reemergence of Pooh.
Pooh, yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, I think the last major Pooh project before that point was The New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, and then there had been this kind of calm period, and then Pooh had this resurgence in the mid-latter 90s.
Yeah, yeah. But Pooh's Grand Adventure, because it didn't have any, there wasn't anything, it was small and intimate. It was very sweet.
Oh, I love that. So at this point, I'm going to ask you a random question that I usually ask a random question of each of my guests that is not necessarily a set question, like the music ones. So my random question for you is, which Disney character did you most enjoy thinking of or executing original songs for in your lineup of projects?
Well, what popped into my head right away was Belle. But I also could easily say that it was Nala in The Lion King.
Hmm.
And then if I were to should I go on? Because some of my favorite voices of character voices are Susan Egan, Heather Headley.
Or on the back of your book, no less.
The experience of working with them, and as you say, Broadway talent beyond, and then some. Of course, Idina, you know, but that she was a character called Circe in Hercules long before she became, you know, the Disney princess that she is now. I could also say that, you know, actually working with Goofy or Mickey and Minnie, and early on in the career, that was the excitement of getting to work with the core Disney core characters, creating songs for them. That was just, it's like, you know, I felt like I was a little A&R department, you know, artists and repertoire, and they were our artists. And, yeah, you know, we're getting songs written to and performing. I mean, that Mousersize. I mean, that was Mousersize, totally Minnie. Yeah. And I, by the way, I'd be really remiss if I didn't mention the Silvershires, Michael and Patty Silvershire, who are incredible songwriters. They wrote such great songs like Pig Out and other songs from, and they were part of the early days of television animation before I actually moved over to television animation. They worked on all the Duck shows. So I can't, again, it's like asking you to pick one, you know?
Fair enough.
As your favorite. Can't do it.
Well, and you have threads in so many different places that I can see how that'd be difficult. Bambi, last but not least, how can listeners pick up a copy of Part of the Magic and follow your continued work?
Well, I'm happy to say that the University Press of Mississippi has published the book, and it's listed as biography and popular culture. They can buy it at the university if they want to support the University Press. That would be great. It's available where you buy all your books. So Amazon, Barnes and Noble, it's available as an ebook. And if people want to reach out to me, you can go to Part of the Magic Book and on Instagram.
Bambi, it has been such a treat to talk with you today. Thank you for relaying these stories and making sure they're not just in one's head, but rather documented, written down, and shared even further today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brett. I really enjoyed it. And I think that you continue to do what you're doing, because it you make audiences aware of a lot of the people behind the scenes. And I think that's really important.
Appreciate it. Thanks again for joining me on another episode of Notably Disney. I invite you to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. Follow me on Twitter at BNachmanReports. That's BNachmanReports. And be among the first to find out about the release of new episodes. I also encourage you to send me an email to notablydisney@gmail.com regarding your thoughts of the show, as well as suggestions for content. So until we turn the page on another chapter, I'm Brett, and thanks for listening to Notably Disney. Notably Disney is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company or any of its subsidiaries. Consequently, the perspectives and opinions expressed by the host and guests are strictly theirs and do not represent the views of the Walt Disney Company and its employees. The main purpose of the Notably Disney podcast is to offer information and critiques about the Walt Disney Company.